headlines, the self-proclaimed republics of Donetsk and Lugansk, as well as two other regions in Ukraine, hold the fifth and final day of referendums to join Russia. Turkey protests over Greece deploying dozens of U.S. armored vehicles on non-military islands in the Aegean Sea. Also in this newscast, Japan's decision to hold a state funeral for assassinated former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe becomes controversial. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Kisumisha Ahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. People in four Ukrainian regions are voting on the fifth and final day of referendums on joining Russia. The polls are underway in the self-proclaimed republics of Donetsk and Lugansk in the east, as well as the Russian-controlled Kherson and Zaporizhia regions. Russia has already said that it will give full protection to the regions if they vote to join the country. President Vladimir Putin has also backed the referendums. However, Ukraine says those who are involved in the process will face treason charges. The U.S. and its Western allies have also strongly criticized the referendum as a sham and illegitimate. They have promised to continue their military support for Kiev. Political analyst Tim Kirby says the referendums can be seen as a game changer in the ongoing Ukraine war.
Now that they're going to become a part of Russia proper, this really changes the rules. This is no longer some sort of means of assistance, but any attacks that would be on Russia would be considered to be essentially an act of war against Russia itself. In fact, they've already declared, as many political analysts assume today, that this is going to turn into an anti-terrorist action, I believe was the proper terminology, to remove the rest of the Ukrainian forces from these four regions. However, if they continue to fight, then real traditional total war, in the sort of World War II sense of total war, would be declared, and that would change the nature of the conflict very much.
Russia's president has granted citizenship to the American whistleblower Edward Snowden amid heightened tensions with the U.S. over the war in Ukraine. The Kremlin says President Putin approved the citizenship for former U.S. intelligence contractor after he filed a relevant request. Snowden has been living in Russia for the past 9 years. He was given asylum in 2013 after Washington revoked his American passport for exposing secret files related to the U.S. National Security Agency. The documents revealed vast domestic and international surveillance operations by the NSA. He is now facing charges of espionage and theft of government property in the U.S., which could put him in prison for decades. State Department spokesman Ned Price said on Monday that Snowden should return to the U.S. to face justice. The UK pound sterling has slumped to a record low against the dollar in the wake of the government's last week announcement of the biggest tax cuts in 50 years. Said Purisa reports.
The British pound takes a pounding yet again, only days after the country's finance minister announced the biggest tax-cutting package in decades, all funded by borrowing at a time of high inflation. They termed it a mini-budget, but it was a mega shift in direction. The Chancellor confirmed the government would implement Prime Minister Liz Truss's leadership campaign pledges to reverse the national insurance rise, cancel the corporation tax rise, and a surprise new tax cut for the highest earners.
Take the additional rate of income tax. At 45%, it is currently higher than the headline top rate in G7 countries like the US and Italy. And it is even higher than social democracies like Norway. But I'm not going to cut the additional rate of tax today, Mr. Speaker. I'm going to abolish it altogether.
Ordinary Britons may not think about exchange rates on a daily basis, but a fall in the pound will affect their day-to-day.
Britain imports nearly half of its foodstuffs, and therefore the pound gets weaker, the cost of those basic foodstuffs goes up dramatically. And so anything which is coming in will be hitting inflation at a time when you don't want to have that. The only good news part of this will be actually your exports are now better value. The trouble is, if the global demand is shrinking, therefore the demand for those exports would also be shrinking.
There are also concerns about a long recession as winter looms with no end in sight to the energy crisis or the war in Ukraine. Online, calls for a general election are gaining traction. And in the Conservative Party itself, rumors about a no-confidence vote in the brand new prime minister.
Some experts say the UK's central bank, the Bank of England, could intervene to halt the pound sliding. Many others are saying the government's decision to borrow its way out of the current situation could end in tears. Saipur is up, London.
Ankara has summoned the Greek ambassador over alleged provocations in the Aegean Sea, where the two sides have been at odds over the status of the two islands. Turkey is angered by Greece for deploying armored vehicles on the two islands of Lebos and Samos. Ankara says that this is in violation of the international law and is calling on Athens to respect the formally agreed non-military status of the area. The Turkish government has also sent a protest note to the U.S. that after Ankara shared recorded aerial images showing ships loaded with U.S.-made military equipment docking at the islands. In response, Greece has rejected Turkish accusations as unfounded. The two nations are at odds over a slew of issues, including commercial rights in the Aegean Sea and territorial waters in the eastern Mediterranean Sea. Political analyst Karel Varikin says Washington's footsteps can be traced in the Greek-Turkey tensions because the U.S. is a declining Western power and is after proxy wars in line with its own interests.
It's because we have a declining Western system, which is both bankrupt financially and which is increasingly oriented towards war confrontation with the rest of the world. And the rest of the world is organizing to try to survive with payment systems outside of the IMF and outside of the dollar zone. And Turkey, which is a bridge between the East and the West, is both a member of NATO, but on the other side, it is increasingly getting closer to the BRICS and to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. So the problem here is, of course, the Greek-Turkish tensions are very old, but the problem is that the global security order of the last 20 years has been breaking down, opening a Pandora box where all these other these frozen conflicts are being reunited on different local levels.
Japan is holding a state funeral for assassinated former Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, but the government is receiving a backlash with many people opposing the ceremony. Hundreds have gathered near the venue of the event in the capital, Tokyo, in protest. Over the past weeks, Japan has witnessed growing public opposition to the ceremony. Thousands of people have signed a petition against the move over its cost, but that is not the only source of their anger. There have been a number of revelations about links between the former prime minister's political party and a controversial religious group known as the Unification Church. Abe was shot dead on the 8th of July when he was attending a campaign rally in the city of Nara. He was the longest-serving prime minister in Japan. Geopolitical analyst Ryan Dawson sheds more light on the opposition of a segment of the Japanese population to the state funeral for Shinzo Abe.
Yeah, well, one, it's usually reserved for emperors. It is costing $12 million. But I don't think that's the sincere reason government will spend $12 million in a day anyway. It's they don't like Shinzo Abe, and they're looking for an excuse, a more acceptable pretext to say, we don't want a state funeral. The LDP should have paid for his funeral. His party should have paid, not the government. His party's in charge of the government with Kishida, but usually in the past, if there was any other prominent figure, including other prime ministers, their party would pay for their funeral. You don't make it a state funeral. And so they are elevating him and saying this is for his legacy, but decided by whom? Some people really did not like Abenomics, did not like his policies, thought he was too right-wing, too militant, and then others obviously disagree. But it should have been the party that paid for it. It shouldn't cost even, you know, $12 million is a hefty sum, but I think they're more or less motivated by not liking his policies, and then it was uncovered after his assassination, and it really brought light to this, that he may have had ties to the Unification Church in South Korea, which is why Tetsuya shot him.
Tensions are spiraling in the Korean Peninsula as the South and the U.S. begin joint war games. North Korea is now warning of war.
The United States is now planning, even at this moment, to conduct joint military exercises, which arouses serious concerns in the surroundings of the Korean Peninsula. Obviously, this is an extremely dangerous act of igniting the fuse to drive the situation on the Korean Peninsula to the brink of war.
Addressing the UN General Assembly, Kim also criticized the UN Security Council for imposing sanctions on North Korea over its nuclear program. He said the UNSC punishes Pyongyang for bolstering its defense capabilities but remains silent on the reckless U.S. arms buildup and war crimes. The U.S. has stationed nearly 30,000 troops in South Korea. Its joint naval drills on South Korea's east coast are the first in 5 years and come a day after Pyongyang conducted another ballistic missile launch. North Korea sees such drills as preparation for an invasion. Earlier this month, the North revised its nuclear weapons law, allowing it to carry out a first strike and vowing never to give up its nukes. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Seoul, Frank Smith. He gave us a picture of the situation on the Korean Peninsula, saying the new policies adopted by the North and the South will likely further raise their tensions.
Well, looking at the shift in their law in terms of institutionalizing the potential use of nuclear weapons by North Korea, we need to recognize that that's conditioned upon an attack. If North Korea is attacked, now it says it will respond with nuclear weapons. That also comes in the wake of a shift in South Korea's sort of military posture and a request by the new South Korean president, a new hardline president here, Yoon Suk-yeol, for the military here in South Korea to develop the capability of striking the North Korean leadership directly in the case of some type of conflict. So we see a shift then in North Korea's nuclear response policy in terms of delegating that to field commanders in the case that North Korea is attacked. So again, this kind of raises the tension on the Korean Peninsula, the sort of time period for warning as a conflict might escalate, and the likelihood of an error taking place in terms of forces perhaps anticipating an attack that might not have been taking place, or misreading the military exercises or maneuvers of the other side. It is kind of a dangerous road that the forces of South Korea, the United States, as well as North Korea are headed toward, that again opens up the potential for risk of conflict on the Korean Peninsula.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps warns that it will target the source of any operations against the country, wherever it may be. The IRGC Deputy Chief for Operations says Iran will never allow the emergence of any threat near its border. Brigadier General Abbas Nilfurushan said the recent artillery and drone attacks on Iraq's Kurdistan region were carried out as part of the same strategic approach. He added that the bases played the biggest role in the recent riots in Iran. Nilfurushan stressed that the IRGC attacks were legitimate defense and that Iran had previously declared that it would respond to such threats strongly and decisively. Lebanese workers and depositors tried to storm Parliament on Monday amid the country's economic crisis. Retired military personnel demanded better monthly pay, while depositors called on the banks to release their life savings. Maram Saleh reports.
The crisis hit Lebanon is once again a scene of angry masses. The Parliament is back to meet and debate a new budget. Yet protesters see the budget being discussed as elusive.
Instead of putting together a budget which encourages development in agriculture, industrial production, and oil fields in Lebanon, they want to impoverish the people and push them to die in the sea as they immigrate illegally. The government, which relies on debt, is being controlled by a mob, which is the Banks Association and the Central Bank. They should be held accountable for getting billions of dollars out of the country.
Banks reopened partially on Monday following a week-long closure in the wake of a wave of holdups. Depositors stormed at least 7 bank branches in the capital and abroad, demanding their trapped savings.
We know these banks, you know, where we invested our money. But unfortunately, they stole the money between themselves, and they plan, and every time they create a story.
One woman named Saleh Hafiz forced one branch to give her $13,000 of her savings, saying she needed it to pay for her sister's medical treatment. But she didn't take back her money on her own.
They left us no other choice. We encouraged Saleh, and we were with her when she held up the bank, because it was a humanitarian situation, and we will be with all the people who urgently need their money. Our government is rotten and corrupt, and so is the judicial system.
The entire governmental sector is paralyzed. The workers, the military personnel, the ministerial workers, the public teachers, they all have rights and they can barely do their job. There's no health care, no educational assistance. The budget plan the parliament is debating today is unfair.
Lebanon's economic downfall began in October 2019. The Lebanese pound has lost around 90% of its value against the U.S. dollar, but officials have failed to put in place necessary reforms. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
We here at Arabi English Radio express our heartfelt condolences to all of our Muslim listeners on the occasion of 30th of Safar, the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Reza, peace be upon him, the 8th infallible successor to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is Taqwa, Thursday the 2nd of Ramadan, 1394, 19 September, 1974. Surah Ali Imran, 132-134. And obey Allah and the Messenger so that you may be granted mercy, and hasten towards your Lord's forgiveness in a paradise as vast as the heavens and the earth, prepared for the God-weary, those who spend in ease and adversity and suppress their anger and excuse the people, and Allah loves the virtuous. Surah Ali Imran, Surah number 3, verse 132-134. To keep their hearts free from sin, some Christians adopted a monastic way of life. They sought refuge in the solitude of caves and mountains. The Quran says, "But as for the monasticism, they innovated it. We had not prescribed it for them." The Quran, Surah 57, verse 27. However, the Islamic scholar cannot live the life of a monk. He cannot withdraw from society. He cannot retreat to the mountains. The Islamic scholar is the one who rushes in to save others. A thinking Muslim is like this. Any Muslim person, insofar as being a Muslim and bearing moral responsibility go hand in hand, is like this. They rush to rescue one who is drowning, to save one who is in danger, to care for one who is sick. They do not run away.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
A Muslim makes himself God-weary, muttaqi, by equipping himself with piety, taqwa, literally protection, meaning the necessary arms and armor to protect himself from sinning before entering the place of sin in order to take the sinners out. This is the essence of taqwa. If this is taqwa, does this mean that taqwa is a necessary requirement and means of attaining success or not? As you can see, the answer is straightforward. It is a means of attaining success. If someone wants to treat an outbreak of disease in a particular area and he is constantly worrying that he will be infected just by being there, how can he possibly hope to save others from it? Before he can go to the affected area and rescue others, he must first be sure about himself. It is then that he will succeed. It is then that he can easily undertake his mission. As Allah says, "And be wary of Allah so that you might be successful."
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Indications are coming from the UK Prime Minister Liz Truss,
who is considering to break with decades-old tradition and move the UK embassy from Tel Aviv to Al-Quds. This move has been strongly criticized by not only Palestinians, but the UN. A number of special rapporteurs have said relocating the British embassy to Al-Quds would break with international law and UN resolutions and reverse decades of British policy.
The capital of Israel. Thank you.
The potential move of the embassy to Al-Quds follows the footsteps of the former U.S. President Donald Trump.
President Trump, by recognizing history, you have made history.
Also led to Palestinians' fierce condemnation, leading to protests and clashes in which Israeli forces killed dozens of Palestinians. Even the former UK Prime Minister Theresa May criticized the move at the time. Special Rapporteur focused on Palestine has said, two or more wrongs do not make a right. Acts altering character, status, the demography of Al-Quds have no legal effects and are null and void and must be rescinded. But why would the UK Prime Minister consider such a move when the UK is grappling with a series of crises which are more important for a new Prime Minister, like a cost of living crisis that has gripped the UK, getting worse by the day? Liz Truss has not hidden the fact of her pro-Israeli stance. She has said that under my leadership, Israel will have no stauncher friend in the world. That's what I've done as Foreign Secretary and Trade Secretary. I don't just talk the talk, I walk the walk. She also said that she would further solidify her ties with Israel by signing a free trade deal with Israel. This is interesting since she has rejected that notion with the U.S. at this point in time. Liz Truss has admitted that the UK will not strike a post-Brexit free trade deal with the US for a number of years. The controversial consideration by the UK Prime Minister to move UK's embassy from Tel Aviv to Al-Quds may have been put in overdrive when Truss made this promise to Israel during her campaign to become Prime Minister. During the Tory leadership contest, she addressed this to an influential lobby group called the Conservative Friends of Israel. But who is the Conservative Friends of Israel? It is a British parliamentary group affiliated to the Conservative Party. It's dedicated to strengthening business and political ties between the UK and Israel, as well as between the British Conservative Party and the Israeli Likud Party. At one point, for example, it was accused of bankrolling the Tories, where 50% of the MPs in the shadow cabinet are Conservative Friends of Israel members. Back in 2017, secret tapes exposed the amount of Israeli influence over the UK Conservative Party. Israeli embassy linked political operators discussed taking down Foreign Minister Alan Duncan, boasting of planting parliamentary questions. This expose revealed how the senior political officer at the Israeli embassy in London discussed a potential plot to take down British politicians, including a minister of state at the Foreign Office who supported Palestinian civil rights. Desmond Sway, a former Conservative minister and parliamentary aide to former Prime Minister David Cameron, described it best when he said at the time that what we cannot have is Israel acting in the UK with the same impunity that it enjoys in Palestine. Clearly, an interference in another country's politics of the murkiest and most discreditable kind. It is no secret that Israel uses its lobby power in the U.S. to have Washington make decisions in its favor, especially the powerful lobby group AIPAC. This covers things like supporting Israel at the U.N., approving arms sales in the billions of dollars, to pro-Israel stance when it comes to issues like illegal settlements. Now Israel has a pro-hawkish prime minister in Downing Street that it can count on. And for as long as she is in office, Israel is making sure that she will act on Israel's behalf. It is not that far off to conclude that Truss has promised favors for Israel when it comes to the issue of doing business in exchange for Israeli investment, so that together we can create well-paid, high-value jobs in both countries, as stated by the International Trade Secretary Anne-Marie Trevelyan. Her new tax cuts, described as trickle-down economics, was reported to disproportionately benefit the rich and make her unpopular. This may, by default, involve Israeli businesses who would warmly receive her plans to slash taxes despite the economic crisis. Referendums have begun in the Ukrainian regions of Luhansk, Donetsk, Zaporizhzhia, and Kherson. The voting is set to run for 5 days until September 27. These referendums have been blasted by the West.
The very international order that we have gathered here to uphold is being shredded before our eyes. We cannot, we will not allow President Putin to get away with it.
As members of the Security Council, we must unequivocally reject Russia's attempts to annex Ukrainian territory.
But in contrast to how the media has called it illegal, there are many who are in favor of it. Given this support, then how can the referendums be deemed illegal or a sham? Memories are short as to when this war actually started and how many people have been killed. One figure put the number of people killed to at least 13,000. Another puts it at 10,000. Keeping in mind, these are the number of deaths before the war, which began in the year 2014. Russia had tried since 2014 to reach a diplomatic solution with the West over this conflict. It was called the Minsk Agreement. Why the Minsk Agreement failed depends on who you speak to. The former Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych accused Kiev and its U.S. patrons responsible for the poor implementation of the peace agreement. Yet at the heart of the conflict lies NATO's eastward expansion. The Kremlin claims that the West broke a promise that it made in the 1990s not to expand NATO after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Putin said NATO had promised not to expand an inch to the east, promises made to the former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev during negotiations between the West and the Soviet Union over German unification. Back in 1998, NATO was confined to Western Europe, yet today it is at Russia's gate. This shows Putin's accusation of NATO's eastward expansion to hold true. Putin therefore set Ukraine as his red line, hence Crimea, and now the referendums that are taking place in these four regions will set up a wall to stop NATO's eastward expansion. Not surprisingly, the outcome of the referendums are predicted to be in Russia's favor. By incorporating these four areas, Moscow has set up these regions to be part of its own. As such, Ukrainian attacks to retake them can be portrayed as attacks on Russia itself. And this is where things have taken a nuclear turn. Russia can potentially use that to justify even a nuclear response. The U.S. President Joe Biden addressed that threat at the UNGA.
Again, just today, President Putin has made overt nuclear threats against Europe and a reckless disregard for the responsibilities of the non-proliferation regime.
But the Russian president's nuclear warning stemmed from the U.S. and NATO's nuclear threat first. The nuclear threat exchange is enough to make anyone conclude that there should be a solution drawn up immediately before things get out of hand in this conflict. That, however, was thwarted by the West, who was keen on continuing this conflict. Russia and Ukraine may have agreed on a tentative deal to end the war back in April, but the former UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson prevented that from happening. The agreement, in short, would have seen Russia withdraw to its position on February 23, when it controlled part of the Donbas region and all of Crimea. And in exchange, Ukraine would have promised not to seek NATO membership and instead receive security guarantees from a number of countries. The conflict itself cannot end now in the eyes of the West. The profits made from military assistance to Ukraine are staggering. Furthermore, the U.S. is using scaremongering tactics into making European countries, like the Baltic nations in particular, into believing that Russia could target them next for the sake of profits. It was reported U.S. arms manufacturers were not cashing in directly from thousands of missiles, drones, and other weapons, but they stood to profit big time over the long run by supplying countries eager to boost their defenses against Russia. And finally, the U.S. was making massive profits in another area, energy sales to Europe, in particular gas sales. Some single shipments were bringing in $200 million. The U.S. was now sending 60% of its liquefied natural gas exports to Europe, up from less than 20% this time a year ago. And this is a classic case of U.S. war profiteering.
As the war in Ukraine drags on, Russia announces its intent to intensify its military operation there. President Putin has now announced a partial mobilization of Russia's military forces. Putin said the Defense Ministry had recommended drawing military reservists into active service as the country faces a protracted conflict in Ukraine and Donbas. Putin says the measure is necessary because Russia is fighting, quote, the entire Western military machine in Ukraine. Putin further accused Ukraine of backing away from a deal that was in the making to end the war. After certain compromises were reached, Kiev received a de facto direct order to derail all agreements. More weapons were pumped into Ukraine. The Kiev regime deployed more gangs of international mercenaries and nationalists, military units trained to NATO standards and under de facto command of Western advisers. Putin is referring to negotiations that gained momentum following the start of the war back in February. But the West, headed by the United States, pressured Kiev to quit the talks. The West saw the war as an opportunity to contain Russia. In other words, the United States and its allies capitalized on Moscow's moves in Ukraine to settle their long-running differences with the Kremlin. They then began pouring military hardware into East Europe and Ukraine in particular. The United States has already given billions of dollars of military aid to Ukraine and encouraged the leaders in Ukraine to keep up the fight at the expense of their own people. Ukraine has now turned into a battleground used by the United States and its allies in their fight against Russia. During his Wednesday speech, President Putin also commented on the upcoming referendums in the two Donbas republics and two regions of Ukraine currently controlled to a large extent by Russian troops. They are putting to a general vote a proposal to ask Moscow to accept them as new parts of the Russian Federation. The polling is scheduled for Friday. Back in February, Russia recognized the two Donbas regions of Luhansk and Donetsk as sovereign republics. However, Kiev lost de facto control of both in 2014 when the local populations rejected the outcome of the Western-backed Maidan coup. But it now appears that they are set to join Russia, which will further increase tensions. It's believed that Russia's partial mobilization is to prepare for the possible fallout of that decision. Back in 2014, Russia took control of the strategic Crimea Peninsula following a referendum there. Ukraine, backed by the West, has made some inroads into the territories held by Russia. Ukraine's counter-offensive has seen the country recapture the first village in Luhansk. They are also making inroads into the Kharkiv region. Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has claimed that the Russian invaders are now in, quote, panic. But Russia has not given any indication that it's prepared to accept Kiev's demands for a full withdrawal from Ukrainian territory, including areas seized in 2014. It now appears that the confrontation between Russia and the West, which practically started since the fall of the Berlin Wall, has entered a new phase. And there are now concerns that the crisis may develop into a nuclear war between the global powers.
World leaders gathered in New York to attend the UN General Assembly. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi was among the leaders to have attended the international event.
During a speech, President Raisi hailed Iran's, quote, prominent and progressive role in confronting high-handed and interventionist policies, especially terrorism that is instigated and supported by the U.S. Raisi noted that thanks to General Soleimani's commandership, Iran emerged to thwart the plots that were aimed at manipulating the geopolitics of the West Asia region.
the fair pursuit of justice in the face of the crime the former American president admitted to is serving the humanity. We will seek through a fair tribunal to bring to justice those who ordered and those who committed the martyrdom of our beloved General Qasem Soleimani.
Raisi also said that Iran will follow up the prosecution of the former American president Donald Trump through a just court. The assassination of General Soleimani was directly ordered by Trump and occurred near Baghdad Airport on January 3, 2020. Raisi also held the emergence of a new world order that's in the making. The crisis has reshaped the geopolitics of not only Europe, but also the West and East Asia regions. The Ukraine war and the crises that followed have created new alliances and enmities. The U.S.-led bloc is locked in an all-out confrontation with Russia. And in order to avoid Western pressure, Russia has launched its policy to look for allies in the East. Moscow is now getting closer to Beijing and Tehran. And new alliances like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and the BRICS grouping of countries are getting more powerful. The emerging New World Order is giving more weight to multilateralism as the key to overcome the ongoing challenges. The unilateralism of the U.S. is seen as the key obstacle to a more just world order. The fate of many countries, especially countries in the West Asia region, shows that the U.S. is pursuing its own interests against the interests of its allies. Iran is among the countries that has pursued an independent policy since its inception.
Some may have the perception that our ties with Eastern countries such as Russia and China, saying that there are more closer ties with those countries, that is, prior to this administration, there was the perception that the government just focused on merely a number of countries in the West. But if I want to speak about my administration's perspective, it's a balanced one, having a view towards all countries. Any country that wants to cooperate with the Islamic Republic of Iran, we have our policy of interaction and cooperation with all countries with priority given to neighboring states.
And that has drawn anger and frustration on the part of the U.S. and its Western and regional countries. During the U.N. General Assembly, U.S. President Joe Biden criticized Russia for its war on Ukraine.
Russia has shamelessly violated the core tenets of the United Nations Charter. No more important than the clear prohibition against countries taking the territory of their neighbor by force.
But it's high time to remind Washington regime of its long history of wars and interventions all over the world, especially the West Asia region.
And in terms of the veto, the U.S. president said that veto-wielding members should refrain from excessive use of their veto power. This is while the U.S. has deployed its veto power dozens of times to protect Israel.
The U.S. must also be held accountable for its use of double standards when it comes to the issue of human rights.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
السلام عليك يا أمين الله في أرض.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRib English Radio, the program To My Brother. I'm Atar, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم فاستجب دعائي واقبل ثنائي واجمع بيني وبين
O Allah, give favorable answer to my prayer. Acknowledge the praise I sign in worship. Let there be peace and harmony between me and my friends for the sake of Muhammad, Ali, Fatima, Al-Hassan, and Al-Hussein. Verily, thou art my benefactor who provides with bounties, the aim of my desires, the ultimate destination of my hopes in my future life and during this short life. Thou art my God, my master and my Lord. Welcome my friends, keep our enemies away from us. To save us from the evil mischief, divert their attention. Let the true world come out in the open, supreme and dominant. Refute and condemn the folly, rendered contemptible. Verily, thou art able to do all things.
إنك على كل شيء
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program is To My Brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam. Dear friends, you know, when it comes to the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam, we find that Imam Ali was truly a very hard-working individual. He put forth a lot of effort when it came to physical and manual labor. We have all heard the stories about Imam Ali planting date palm orchards. And also we have heard of the stories of Imam Ali alayhi salam building or digging water wells. Of course, both of these things in an era where both of these things, water and dates, were something that truly created and generated a lot of wealth. But despite this creation of wealth, we find that Imam Ali would give all of it away on the path of Allah for the sake of Allah. And so he would help the needy, he would help the poor, he would help the widows, he would help the orphans.
all via these different means in which he worked and put forth manual and physical labor. It's interesting, along these lines, we find that Imam Ali says, O son of Adam, do not devote your utmost effort to a day which is not the last day of your life. For Allah will provide you with daily food throughout the days of your life. If you gain what is in excess of your daily food, you have saved it for someone else. So the pain is all yours, and the gain is that of the heir and the inheritor. So, dear friends, of course, we must work hard in our lives. We must try our best to make our ends meet. But sometimes we spend all of our time and all of our efforts, and as Imam Ali says, we end up spending the utmost effort to our daily income, our daily sustenance, more than what is required. Now, that's fine if you want to work hard and earn a good living, as long as you remember to give away this earning to a certain extent on the path of Allah and for the sake of Allah. Because, of course, just hoarding up and amassing wealth, not only will you not be able to use it, but you worked hard for it. As Imam Ali says, that the pain is all yours. But who's the one who's going to truly benefit from it? Well, it is the heir, the inheritor, who will have the gain. And of course, there's nothing wrong with leaving something as an inheritance, you know, to your children or to the generations to come. But keep in mind that it is the hereafter that we must be putting forth our utmost effort in. We should be working the hardest for our hereafter. We should not be working simply to gain this worldly material benefit just for the sake of worldly material benefit. Rather, the ultimate home, the eternal home, the home which is infinity and timeless, is the hereafter. And so all of our actions in this world must work towards that ultimate goal of the hereafter. A beautiful and profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother. My name is Muhammad. After returning from the Battle of Siffin, Imam Ali gave certain pieces of advice to one of his sons. Historians consider him to be Imam Hassan alayhi salam, while others are of the opinion that he was Muhammadul Hanafiya. He wrote this letter in the form of a will. They deal with almost every aspect of life, which goes a long way to make a man successful in life, brave, humane, generous, virtuous, and pious. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from the last will of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. My dear son, those people who have carefully studied the conditions of life and the world pass their days as if they know that there are travelers who have to leave a place which is famine-stricken, unhealthy, and uncongenial, and they have to proceed towards lands which are fertile, congenial, and where there is abundant provision
of all comforts and pleasures. They have eagerly taken up the journey, happy in the hope of future blessings and peace. They have willingly accepted the sufferings, troubles, and hazards of the way, parting of friends, scarcity of food and comfort during the pilgrimage, so that they may reach the journey's end, a happy place. They do not refuse to bear any discomfort and do not grudge any expenditure by way of giving out alms and charities and helping the poor and the needy. Every step which they put forward towards their goal, however tiring and exhausting it may be, is a happy event of their lives. On the contrary, the condition of those people who are solely engrossed in this world and are sadly engulfed in its short-lived, quickly fading and vicious pleasures is like that of travelers who are staying in fertile and happy regions and who have to undertake a journey, knowing fully well that the journey is going to end in a rough, arid, and infertile land.
Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Wali means the leader, the master. Awliya in the spiritual circles is used for those who are known as spiritual masters in plural. And Ali is known as Waliyul Awliya. He is the master of the spiritual masters of the world. The ayat from Surah number 5, Surah Maidah, ayat 55, it's easy to remember, 5:55, is an ayat where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, Innama waliyukum Allah. Innama is for emphasis and exclusivity. Verily, only Allah is your wali. وَرَسُولُهُ Your wali is only Allah and His Messenger. وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا الَّذِينَ يُقِيمُونَ الصَّلَاةِ وَيُؤْتُونَ الزَّكَاةِ وَهُمْ رَاكِعُونَ Allah and Rasul we know. But the third person after Allah and Rasul whom He includes in this exclusive status of wilayat, mastership, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, for the reasons He knows and we know, didn't name Him. Himself He mentioned, إِنَّمَا وَلِيُّكُمُ اللَّهُ وَرَسُولُهُ But then He just describes Him. Although the wordings are in plural, but in Arabic grammar there is no problem. Sometimes you talk about one individual, but you use the words as if you are talking about a group. You know, so this is the way Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, your master is only Allah and His Messenger. وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا And those who have iman. If all those who have iman, they are masters of all others who have iman, doesn't make sense. It refers to one individual there. And then Allah says further, those who establish prayers and give charity while they are in the state of ruku, and that refers to none other than Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali bin Abi Talib alayhi salatu wassalam.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Classified.